Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. Find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Sandeep Roy, editor with New America Media and host of the radio program New America Now, and your moderator for today's program. And now it is my pleasure to introduce today's distinguished speaker, Raj Patel, activist, journalist, and author, whose latest book is The Value of Nothing: How to Reshape Market Society and Redefine Democracy. Academic and writer Raj Patel has been called a public intellectual to watch, but he might be the only one who has both worked for the World Bank and WTO and been tear-gassed protesting them. He has a master's from the London School of Economics and a PhD in development sociology from Cornell University. He's organized for food sovereignty, and his first book, Stuffed and Starved, won him international acclaim and landed him in front of the House Financial Services Committee, testifying about the global food crisis. The global economic crisis is at the heart of his new book, The Value of Nothing. But as is usual with Raj Patel, instead of just focusing on what went wrong, he also writes about what is going right and presents an alternate vision of the world and markets. And even if you don't always agree with that vision, it sounds convincing because he delivers it in a British accent. Please welcome Raj Patel.
Hi there. That's about as American as I'm going to get for today. Thank you all for coming. Why don't we start with the title of the book, The Value of Nothing. It is important to note that the full quote is, "Nowadays, people know the price of everything and the value of nothing." That quote comes from Oscar Wilde. And it is important to observe and to remember that Oscar Wilde was a socialist. And it's important just to say the word socialist and not hear then the howls and derision that one commonly associates. Because, I mean, there's this Monty Python sketch, I don't know if you know it, happens. Do you know the bicycle repairman sketch? It was one of the very few Monty Python sketches that they did in an American accent. The story was that in a world of bicycle repair, in a world of Superman, everyone was dressed as Superman. They're walking around fighting crime. But one of those Supermen was, by night, a working-class bicycle repairman. He fixed bicycles and this lovely scene where he fixed the bicycle and then he strolls off into the distance and there's this voiceover of, "And so wherever bicycles are menaced by potholes or by international communism," the sort of speaker then launches into, "And the communists, I hate them, dirty red scum, in Britain, watching this as a child, it seemed just very weird that Americans would get so exercised over the word communism. So some of the ideas that I'm presenting to you today have a pedigree of socialism and of communism. Though I myself am not a communist, I'm just open-minded. But I do want to sort of get that out there, because it is important to remember that Oscar Wilde, among many other intelligent people of his time and independent thinkers, were socialists. Everyone from Albert Einstein to Martin Luther King towards the end of his life. It's important, I think, to get back to this idea of the difference between price and value, because we are beguiled by prices. It's interesting. I think it would be odd if it were a Martian to descend to Earth. I think that Martian would be surprised that one of the most popular game shows, not just in the United States but around the world, is The Price is Right, where people guess are intended to guess the value of objects that are paraded in front of them. Of course, even when we know the price of something, we're often beguiled by it. I talk a lot in the book about hamburgers. The price of a $4 hamburger is much higher than we suspect. Researchers in India did a study where they looked at the environmental cost associated with raising cows on pasture that once upon a time used to be rainforest. And that rainforest performs functions in terms of carbon sequestration, in terms of being part of a water cycle, in terms of nutrient cycling, in terms of providing a haven for biodiversity. And you can assign a fairly conservative dollar value to that. And if you do, it turns out that a $4 hamburger could cost as much as $200. And that's just the environmental costs. I mean, if you're eating a hamburger in the United States, the chances are that hamburger will come with tomatoes. Now, those tomatoes will likely come from, particularly this time of year, come from southern Florida. And in southern Florida, the tomato pickers are paid pennies for a pound of tomatoes. They will pick over 2 tons of tomatoes every day and get paid just a few dollars for it. And in southern Florida, there are workers who have been picking the tomatoes that appear everywhere from McDonald's to Taco Bell to Walmart, who have been in conditions of modern-day slavery. Since 1997, over 1,000 people have been freed from conditions of modern-day slavery. And this isn't just sort of tough working conditions. These are people being chained up in trailers, people who have been charged $5 to have a shower so they can wash the pesticides off them. And in fact, some people find it cheaper to wash their hands in bleach than to pay the $5 for a shower. Now, their suffering doesn't feature at all in the price of a hamburger. And they have been freed by the statutes that constituted the Articles of Abolition. In other words, slavery is alive and well in what we consider to be a free market democracy. And yet this idea of slavery is important because slavery is an example of where we allowed the market to commodify human bodies. We allowed people to be bought and sold in markets, and then we turned the clock back. We decided through politics, through struggle, and through organizing, to be able to say, actually, there are some things that don't belong in markets, and one of those things is our fellow human beings. Now, and it's important to recognize that slavery is an instance of where commodification is pushed forward and then pushed back as a result of struggle. Because that's a story that I'm keen to sort of tell you in The Value of Nothing. Let's sort of spend a minute thinking about the difference between price and value. If you take economics 101, price is precisely where supply and demand meet. But that's a trivial story. The obviousness of that is something that Aristotle knew. I mean, when Aristotle was talking about economics, there was oikonomia, the science of provisioning for the household, and then there was the much more mundane and less interesting science of kresmatistics, which is just merely the science of figuring out what the price of goods are when they hit the market. And the earliest economists, the earliest moral philosophers, people like Adam Smith, they knew that the reason that diamonds were more expensive than water, even though water was more necessary for life, they knew that the reason this was the case is because people it was the interaction of supply and demand. But prices for moral philosophers like Adam Smith or Karl Marx, for that matter, prices were the most superficial outcome of a much longer series of interactions around power and around social deliberation and action. If you look at Adam Smith's theory of where value really comes from, of why things cost what they do, Adam Smith believed that it was the labor, the labor that goes into something defines its value. Adam Smith took that labor theory of, Karl Marx took that labor theory of value and pushed it forward and showed how capitalism works by removing an extra layer of value. And what capitalists do is profit from an added surplus value that is available through exchange and commodification. I talk more lucidly about it in the book. Brain fart is an American word that I'm becoming increasingly familiar with. But that's okay. For me, I think that the interesting thing then is not to rehearse Marxism, but to get us to a place of understanding why it is that we've come to a place where markets and market capitalism is the only way in which we can see to value things. I mean, don't get me wrong. I mean, like Marx, I think capitalism is much better than what preceded it. And like pretty much every commentator, I think that markets are actually quite a good thing. Every human civilization has had markets. Markets provide a venue in which people can interact, people can socialize, people can learn to trust one another. And in the book, I sort of present evidence from a number of civilizations that show that markets can be this amazing venue for interaction. The trouble is that when the goods that are exchanged in that market are produced through modern contemporary capitalism, those markets come to be ways of excluding costs and of shifting away certain indelible externalities. So, for example, if we count the way that we have been consuming in rich countries, if we count the costs that have not been included in the price of the goods that we've been paying, it turns out that we owe poor countries $5 trillion. If you count over the past 40 years the ways that we've been damaging mangroves in developing countries through our consumption of shrimp, for instance, if you count the ways that we've been contributing to a hole in the ozone layer and the days of life lost as a result of that, if you count the costs of overfishing, if you count the costs of climate change, of agricultural intensification, it turns out that we owe poor countries $5 trillion. This was a study in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences a couple of years ago. And yet, if you look at the way that we do accounting at the moment, it looks like poor countries owe us $1.8 trillion. But we owe them $5 trillion. So there's something fundamentally wrong with the mathematics of environmental exploitation, certainly. And if you look at the way that capitalism systematically underpays women's labor, this is another feature that economists have tried to put a dollar value to, trying to put a dollar value to the amount of work that goes on in the home, the amount of work that usually women put into childcare. And when the last time a major study was done on this in 1995, it turns out that women's unpaid work constitutes around $17 trillion, more than half of the world's domestic product, which is uncounted by modern market capitalism. And that's not to say it doesn't have a value. It's just to say that it doesn't have a price. And yet we remain blinded by the possibilities of markets. I don't know if you remember in 2008 when Alan Greenspan was in front of the House Oversight Committee, and he had an interaction with Henry Waxman, and Henry Waxman had summoned him, had summoned Greenspan to sort of explain what the hell happened. Alan Greenspan had presided over the Federal Reserve and had been widely hailed as the smartest man alive. And so, in the aftermath of the financial collapse in 2008, he was called to explain himself. Initially, he opened with the idea that, if only we'd had data from more than 20 years and fed that into our models, we wouldn't have been caught short. We'd have seen this coming. And Henry Waxman pushed back. And in the end, Greenspan was forced to admit that there was something wrong with the model. And he admitted that there was a flaw in the model of how he thought the world was functioning for the past 40 years. Now, that's a huge thing to admit. It's as if the Pope were suddenly to say, yeah, you know, God, we just made him up. Yeah, he doesn't even have a beard. Or if the Dalai Lama were to sort of take a machine gun and say, violence does solve everything. It's an admission of seismic proportions. And yet, I don't think we're able to process the magnitude of that kind of admission. It's like in the Kafka novella, Metamorphosis, where Gregor Samsa wakes up after a night of bad dreams and wakes up to find himself transformed into a cockroach. And what does Gregor Samsa do? Well, he doesn't worry about why he's turned into a cockroach. He doesn't wonder what he'll wake up as tomorrow morning. The first thing that Gregor Samsa worries about is his job. And that's interesting because that's pretty much the way that we've responded to this economic crisis. I mean, we've heard the systemic, we've heard about the systemic failures of the market, and the first thing we worry about is how we're going to survive. Now, of course, that's a reasonable thing to worry about. I mean, particularly in this economy, it's reasonable to worry about our job, but it's also reasonable to worry about why we came to be in this mess. And in the book, I talk about why it's so difficult to think our way out of this. In part, it's because the alternatives that we have to valuing things have been hidden from us. That's why I began with this sort of observation about Oscar Wilde being a socialist. I mean, in many ways, particularly in the United States, these kinds of alternative ways of valuing things have been scorned and shoved to one side. Of course, to some extent, we ourselves have been co-opted and seduced by consumer culture. I talk in the book about Anton's blindness. Now, Anton's blindness is a neurological deficit. It happens when you have a stroke or when you have a traumatic brain injury. People who have Anton's blindness are cortically blind. They can't see what's in front of them. And yet, if you have Anton's blindness, you insist that you can see. Anton's blindness is a strange condition where, even though you are cortically blind, you insist that you can see. The way that Anton's blindness is diagnosed is when people who are cortically blind, well, they'll bump into things and they'll stub their toe. And the way that they'll justify that is, oh, well, I'm just being clumsy. I just didn't see that there. And they will confabulate. They will make up stories about how what they deeply believe to be true has to be reconciled with the world that they've just run into. That's a metaphor for how we're dealing with the failure of the free market to value things. We're making up stories. We're saying, well, if only we regulate, if only we're able to bring rein the banks in and cap bonuses, we'll be able to get back to normal. But the fact is that we need other ways of seeing, because our faulty sight through markets has systematically let us down. And yet, of course, there's something attractive about free markets. The word free in free markets is very powerful. It's important to unpick that a little bit. I mean, we think of free markets, we think liberty, freedom, liberty. Who doesn't want liberty? I want to suggest that markets are not the natural houses of liberty. The Oxford philosopher Jerry Cohen had a fantastic thought experiment. He said, well, if you think that markets are about freedom, if you think markets are about rights and about liberties, then here's a thought experiment for you. Imagine a world where everyone is given little tickets, and on those tickets are freedoms, rights, if you will. You have the right to drive a red sports car. You have the right to decent healthcare. You have the right to visit your ailing grandmother. You have the right to go on holiday to Tenerife. Now, you may not want to cash in these tickets, but if you have those tickets, those are the things that you can do. And if you don't have tickets and you try to do something that's not on one of your tickets, then the police will intervene. What Cohen suggests is actually, those tickets are a very specific kind of money. And the world in which we live, really, you can imagine the world that we're living in as where those tickets are replaced by dollar bills. Because the more dollar bills you have, the freer you are to visit your sick aunt, the freer you are to have good healthcare or to go on holiday to Tenerife. But if you don't have those tickets, you are fundamentally unfree. You are deprived of rights. Through this market, freedom is just another word for the poorest Americans. Freedom is just another word for nothing that they can afford. And that's a very true reflection, particularly if you look, for example, at healthcare right now in the United States. If you look at the layers of historical oppression that women in the United States face, and particularly women of color, you'll see that, for example, African-American women, if they were a country to themselves, their maternal mortality rates would be worse than Uzbekistan. I mean, already maternal mortality rates in the United States have been going down. The rates have been going up. We've been seeing a decline in the levels of maternal health in the United States. And again, all of this has been attended by the expansion of free markets. And so it's important then to just unpick this idea of freedom, of liberty that attends markets. Because, as I say, that idea of liberty is illusory. And yet we've been exporting those markets and exporting that vision of free markets around the world. And I was complicit in that insofar as I worked at the World Bank. Now, the model, sometimes this model was imposed in a very generous way. I mean, it was through charity, through bringing to developing countries these free markets that seem to have worked so well for us here. I think we're all familiar with the idea of, give a man a fish and you feed him for a day, but teach a man to fish and you feed him for a lifetime. And that's that sounds reasonable enough, but and so you'll see the adverts on television about little Tunde is running along the river and he is hungry, but give and we could give him a fish and we would feed him for a day, but if we taught his father to fish, we would feed him for a lifetime, so teach Tunde's dad how to fish and give your dollars, but think of the model that rests on. Right, it constructs people in developing countries as sort of people sitting by the river. They're sort of eating fish, and then and they'll look into the river, and they'll like, so what's that? It looks like a fish. Well, how do we get it out? I have no idea. We will have to wait for the white man to come and tell it. And of course, it's important to remember that actually there are systems of governance that already exist, that there are models of development that already exist in developing countries that actually are much more sustainable than the model of free markets that we have been trying to export. These models look like, for example, the commons. The Nobel Prize in Economics last year was shared in part by Eleanor Ostrom for her work on the commons, on systems of economic governance that are not about free markets, but are about taking resources and managing them cooperatively without necessarily private property rights, but through communal management techniques. Now that may sound that may sound like sort of proto-communism or whatever it is, but it turns out that it's tremendously effective. In a study in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences last year, over 80 forest communities were examined, and if you look at the communities that had higher levels of autonomy and a large forest area to manage, those communities did much better in terms of not only of development indicators and welfare indicators for the people in those forests and in those forest communities, but they sequestered more carbon. They managed the forests much more sustainably than through the intervention of central government or the free market. So in terms of robust examples of actually existing ways of managing resources without markets, they exist, and they exist today. In the book, I'm running short of time here, so I'm going to sort of gloss over the examples that we can see from around the world. I mean, in Brazil, there are examples of participatory budgeting, where citizens from rich and poor neighborhoods debate democratically how it is that they're going to share resources. There are examples in modern market economies where you see engagement from citizens debating and engaging and managing in a commoning, not communing, but commoning, the act of managing together resources in common, that are proving tremendously successful. If people are interested, there are also examples, everything from the Oakland Food Policy Council, which is investigating these kinds of ideas, to the Zapatistas. There are a lot of very interesting examples that have lessons for us here today. Now, when I ended my last talk, when I was talking about Stuffed and Starved, the sort of end point was the observation that what we need to do today is to recognize that we are not consumers of democracy. We need to rise up above being consumers. We are not consumers of democracy. We are its proprietors. We are citizens, and we need to recognize that. And I stand by that. I think that's absolutely right. We do need to recognize that we are citizens. But that's a jumping-off point for me, because what kinds of citizens should we be? The subtitle of the book is about how to reclaim market society. Now, this idea of market society is one that I borrow from Karl Polanyi, a Hungarian philosopher and commentator who was writing in the middle of the Second World War. And he was writing about the process whereby markets turn things into commodities and the way that people fight back in order to fight back against the excesses of the market. Now, Karl Polanyi was writing, as I say, at the end of in the teeth of the Second World War. He saw that when the market went too far, he had around him ample evidence that when people push back against the market, they needn't do so in progressive ways. If you look at the way people became citizens in the 1930s in Europe, for example, the way that people responded to the excesses of the market through citizenship were tremendously exclusionary. The way that people fought back against the excesses of the free market were through exclusion and through tyranny and through fascism. There's nothing that's automatically benign about becoming a good citizen. We need to be thinking about the kinds of citizens we want to be. And that's why this Jerry Cohen example, if you think about money again in the free market, money is the right to have rights. In a free market, the more money you have, the more rights you have. In other words, money is the right to have rights. And I think that if you look at the examples that I spend a lot of time sort of examining in the book, what all of them share in common is a basic commitment to human rights and a basic commitment to the realization of those kinds of rights. And human rights provide a safety net for when communities fail. So the kinds of citizen that I think we should be are the kinds of citizens that are pushing towards a world where we realize an agenda of human rights, an agenda where we do actually get to enjoy the right to have rights. Now, again, this may sound terribly panglossy and pie in the sky, but it's important to remember that right now we are in a moment where there is a counterforce to the excesses of the market. You're seeing the rise of the far right in Europe and to some extent in the United States. You're seeing reactions to the excesses of the market that are exclusionary, that are looking to narrow and to exclude and to persecute. But that needn't be our fate. And again, in the book, I talk a lot about the possibilities, the liberating possibilities of reclaiming markets and actually for us becoming more democratic, having a more democratic way of controlling the economy. And I think that's the place that I want to leave at, because I think it's important for us to realize that what we live in now is not really so much a democracy as a complainocracy. You know, what we live in is a society where, every 2 years we will go to the polls and depending on how well they have pleased us, we will either reinstate our leaders or kick them out and replace them with another group of leaders whose economic philosophy is more or less the same. And we can see a great deal of continuity between the previous administration and this one in terms of economic policy. But it's important to contrast that with genuine democracy. I talk about the few extant examples of democracy that I see in the book. But if you look at Athenian democracy, yes, there was slavery. Yes, there was exclusion of women. And I certainly don't want to live in Athens 2,000 years ago. But I think there's an interesting point about Athenian democracy. Because in Athenian democracy, which is the home of democracy, they weren't elections. They didn't have elections. They didn't have people running for office. What they had was every year, at random, 6,000 citizens would be chosen to govern the city. Those 6,000 citizens would be divided up into groups of 500, and they were the government. And then at the end of that year, they would be disbanded, and another 6,000 would be chosen to run the city. That's democracy. That's very different from what we have right now. We've been systematically de-skilled and actually discouraged from taking political responsibility for ourselves. Instead, we're encouraged to just be good consumers and buy the right things and drive the right car, and that's the kind of responsibility we take. And it's important to be a responsible consumer. I'm encouraging people to be a responsible consumer rather than an irresponsible one. But it's important to us to be responsible citizens. And there are many more impediments to that happening. But as I talk about in the book, and this is a good place to leave it. actually, through the discovery of citizenship, we can not only reclaim market society and figure out ways of putting values on things, but we can encourage the parts of ourselves that are not selfish economic individuals. Through socializing, through engaging with one another, societies around the world have found that we can come to be in touch and develop the parts of ourselves that are not merely selfish individuals, but are generous, are altruistic, are caring. That's not to say that I, I'm just some dope-smoking hippie who thinks that we should go around being altruistic. I know that we are creatures who are selfish. I look into myself and I don't always like what I see. But what everyone from Rousseau to the Zapatistas have observed is that you can put the parts of ourselves that are more generous, are more altruistic, out front. And you can build a better society by getting in touch with them. And again, I mean, if that sounds pie in the sky, remember that the alternative is far, far darker. The 1930s showed what alternatives to the backlash against market society could be. And if we think about the future, if we think about where our world is heading in terms of climate change, in terms of hunger, in terms of deforestation, in terms of a range of environmental social problems that face us, that the market has created, it seems madness to rely on the market to fix these problems. And the good news is there are other ways out there. And as citizens, I think that it's our duty to explore them. Thanks very much.
Our thanks to Raj Patel, activist, journalist, and author, whose latest book is The Value of Nothing: How to Reshape Market Society and Redefine Democracy. It's now time for our audience question period, and we have a number of questions, so let's begin. Maybe I'll start with the hamburger, since it's a good connecting point between your previous book, Stuffed and Starved, and this book. Mm-hmm. But if the price of the tomato picker is actually featured in the price of the hamburger, what would it mean? Would it just mean that the hamburger would become unaffordable and some poor family would have one less option?
That's a great question. And I think, it's become increasingly clear that certain kinds of food have huge costs associated with them, huge externalities that are not paid for. And so you're seeing things like discussions around soda taxes, for instance, and things like ensuring that the price of tomatoes adequately reflects labor. Now, in fact, what the tomato pickers are demanding is a whole one penny more per bucket. We're not talking about a hamburger that actually costs $200. In the case of the Immokalee workers, a penny more per bucket means that their salary doubles from $8,000 to $16,000, something like that. So this really isn't. We're not talking big numbers here, but there is this sort of bigger issue around paying the full cost of stuff that we consume. I certainly think, the thing about tobacco as an example, that's a sort of interesting place to start. I mean, obviously, we know that tobacco has externalities. We know that the health costs associated with smoking are tremendous. And the way that we approached that was to have a comprehensive public health strategy. It wasn't just about banning cigarettes. It was, there was taxation. There was reductions in marketing, so you're not allowed to market tobacco to kids. You educate kids so that you don't, you educate everyone so that people realize what the dangers of smoking are. Yes, you make it increasingly hard to smoke, and you make it increasingly hard to smoke in public, for example. But this idea of a comprehensive public health strategy is important, because if we're going to do things like realize the public health costs of, for example, a great deal of sugar in the American diet, and there are huge public health care costs for that, by the way. One in five American healthcare dollars is spent on someone with diabetes. One in five of our dollars spent on someone with diabetes is $178 billion in 2008. If those costs start to feature in food, that's certainly one element of a public health strategy. So a soda tax is a first step. But we also need to bear in mind that the reason that, for example, working families are buying cheap food, and in the book I say cheap food is actually cheat food, right? Because the full costs are don't feature in this food. But the reason that the poor families go to this food is because it's subsidized and because it is cheap. And so if we're serious about a public health strategy that includes the full environmental and social and healthcare costs of the way that we eat, for example, then we have to talk about wages. We have to talk about the income that people have in order to be able to afford food. There's no point taxing soda or taxing this, that, or the other, and leaving it at that, because then that just ends up being tremendously regressive and a tax on poor people. What we absolutely need is, as a comprehensive public health strategy, we need a living wage. We need a wage so that people can afford to pay the true costs of feeding themselves in a way that doesn't damage the environment, that does respect labor, and that allows poor families to be able to eat properly. So it's not just a consumption-side tax. We need absolutely to pay attention to production.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our guest today is Raj Patel, author and activist who's discussing his critique of America's free market economic system. So we have this question which says, I agree that the current cost, dollars, euro, et cetera, may not be accurate, but at least the costs are somewhat standardized, traceable, and understood. How will those aims be achieved if your system of true costs is to work?
I disagree with the question. I mean, it's not clear to me that costs are transparent or visible in any way. I mean, as I say, I mean the $5 trillion that I was talking about earlier on. I mean, if the debt that we owe poor countries in terms of ecological debt, and that's to totally ignore the social costs of things like European colonialism or slavery, or the debt that we rich countries and usually white people in rich countries have accumulated. Over hundreds of years, those kinds of debts don't seem to be transparent at all, and it's not clear at all that those have those have featured in any way in the way that prices look today. What I'm arguing for is on the one hand a recognition and a process of reparation for those past debts incurred, and that involves negotiating. And actually, there are forums in which we can do that. That there are forums like if we're talking about the debt of colonialism, the World Conference on Racism, World Conference Against Racism, was a forum in which that debt was being discussed. And if you're interested in that, Naomi Klein's article in Harper's is terrific. A really interesting example of the politics of those kinds of negotiation. But what commons systems tend to do is provide a forum in which people live with the consequences of their economic actions. And that's what markets have allowed us to escape, or what market capitalism has allowed us to escape. We've managed to externalize the costs of our actions and shove them off onto other people, or shove them off onto future generations, or shove them off onto the environment. And what common systems tend to encourage is this idea of living with the consequences of your actions. And that means that actually in common systems, there are ways of managing resources that, for example, are not about monetizing them, but about granting people rights to use them, about stinting. The word stinting it actually comes from commoning. It means to choose not to use resources from time to time, in order that those resources are allowed to be maintained. These systems of governance look like people sitting around a table making decisions about how to ensure that next year there's enough to be able to provide for citizens as there was this year. It looks like democracy. It looks like a committee. It looks like meetings. I don't know anyone who is excited about meetings. But there's something that's much better about meetings than there is about the kinds of externalization that we have at the moment. Meetings and the kinds of democracy that I'm talking about offer a venue in which those costs can be external. Those external costs can be internalized, and through which we can learn to sustainably manage those resources.
You know, meetings are very exciting if you have a gavel and you can do it three times.
Yes,
That makes meetings very... Oh, no, you can't do that. That means it's over. So you have... But we have another question, which says, what is the best way to require that the externalities are included in the cost of manufactured goods? Is it correct to assume that because externalities are not included today, we must pass legislation to require it? Or is there another more politically feasible way?
Legislation is politically feasible. When we think about, cigarettes. The reason that we have taxation, that we have public policy in order to regulate the externalities of cigarettes, is through legislation. It is through lobbying. It is through people getting angry and engaged. Can we just wait for that to go? There we are. I certainly think that legislation has worked. And if we're thinking, for example, about climate change, despite the failures in Copenhagen, there are examples of we have models of internalizing externalities, paying for costs, and managing carbon resources very sustainably already. One of those examples that was proposed was something called cap and trade. Cap and trade is this idea that we limit, we provide legislative limits on the amount of carbon that's produced, and then we have permits for that we sell permits to pollute, and let those permits work their way out through a free market, and the free market will decide the appropriate cost of pollution and thereby drive down the amount of pollution that's generated. Now, in the book, I report on how that system has been working in Europe, because Europe's had it for a little while. I have a quote from Citibank, from one of the traders at Citibank, who has been involved in trading these pollution permits. He's very clear about how free markets have been doing with this. And he says, the result of this is that polluters are very happy because they've been allowed to pollute. Bankers are particularly happy because they get to trade in these permits. But the end consumer actually is the one who's been screwed in all of this, because pollution continues. And they're out of pocket with the amount of resources that have been given away to the banks and the polluters. And if you look at the political genealogy of carbon trading, you'll see that essentially it's a deal between big polluters and even bigger banks. But what has worked in Europe is the cap. Legislating limits on pollution. If you look at, for example, in the United States, the legislation around sulfur pollution, what worked best in that legislation was actually limits on the amount of sulfur that was allowed out. That was a legislative way of actually saying, you know what, we don't like this externality. We're just going to stop it. We're going to legislate the limits to this, and we're going to make it go away. And we did. When you look at the way Washington behaves, it's hard not to sort of shake your head and cry, and despair at the prospects of actually sort of decent legislation. And yet we do have a track record of when enough people get behind it, and when it becomes politically necessary to pass that legislation, it becomes possible and it becomes successful.
We have a couple of questions about the Commons, so let me get. So given the anti-government and the if you're poor, it's your fault independent spirit of Americans, how do we overcome rampant self-interest in order to better foster this notion of the commons?
I think the commons is interesting because it's something that appeals to left and right. Yeah, it is suspicious of the power of big government, as well as being suspicious of the power of capitalism. The political thinkers who are very excited by the commons, people like Hart and Negri, for example, they find themselves more leaning towards proponents of anarchism. Rather than a certain kind of right wing or communist philosophy, I think that's something that's important to recognize is in America as well. The idea that it is possible for people to organize and to take political responsibility. I mean, that's I was talking to people earlier on today about actually what the foundational moments of the United States come from a resistance to the British East India Company. And also to the British government, right? I mean, there were moments where this is Arthur Schlesinger's argument because of the way that the British East India Company was basically going to become the Walmart of its generation, that it was going to destroy particularly the livelihoods of middle class colonial Americans. It was the announcement that the British East India Company was going to be selling wholesale in the colonies. That sparked a rebellion. In other words, you know, the history of this country can be traced back to a rebellion against Walmart, against big corporations, and against sort of foreign powers coming in and telling you what to do. Now, it's that spirit is not to be found in the tea baggers of today. It seems to me that there seem to be their mission control is Fox News, and there seems to be much less of the sort of independent thinking and independent mobilization than the original sort of founders of this country. But there is nonetheless in the United States in particular this very sort of profound idea that the people can and should govern themselves. By, for, and of the people is something that isn't just on paper. It's not to be found terribly much in Washington, but it is to be found in a certain spirit of organizing in the United States. And you do see it already. You see it in things like the Oakland Food Policy Council, where people are... yes, we have self-interest. There's a lot of self-interest around. But what you see in the Oakland Food Policy Council is also people caring for one another. And that's another part of what it is to be a citizen, not just of the United States, but to be a member of any community. Yes, there's self-interest, but yes, there's also caring for one another. That's just part of what it is to be a human being. And again, I do want to get away from this idea that somehow all we are is this sort of this theoretical creature of homo economicus. I write a lot about homo economicus in the book, about this assumption that all we are sort of creatures of permanent want and maximization. And that in fact, if you look at the way that we have evolved, the survival of the fittest doesn't mean the survival of people who are the biggest bastards. The survival of the fittest is not about survival of the most selfish. Although we have selfish genes, we are fit through the fact of that we are able to cooperate, that we are able to be generous to one another, that we are social animals. I mean, us and our primate cousins demonstrate that amply. And so it's not just a case of having to be selfish individuals. We can be more than that. And in the US now, through things like food policy councils, through everything from sort of church groups to tenants' organizations fighting for housing, there are these organizations that socialize us into being more... more than just selfish individuals. So I think actually it's already underway here. And there is a certain spirit that actually is very strong in the United States. And that's why tomorrow I'm going to become an American citizen. Because I think that actually if there's a place where this can happen, I think it's here. So that's right. And I'm going to have USA, USA, USA tattooed on my chest. That's normal, right? You all have that, right? I think that there's something very hopeful about this country, and I'm excited to be part of it.
Well, speaking about creatures of permanent want and maximization, what are your thoughts on the characterization of corporations as sociopathic citizens of our democracy? Mm. With your model of money-making individuals free to have rights, how can individuals compete with and reclaim our rights from the rich corporations legally treated as individuals?
That's a wonderful question. It's true that in the United States and around the world, corporations are treated as legal persons. Corporations have the right of free speech. This really blew my mind. This is an obesity-related anecdote, but In Britain, because of rising obesity rates that we see, the Minister for Children, a man who unfortunately called Ed Balls, was saying, look, if we're going to have... We have a national healthcare system in Britain, and he was saying, look, because of this obesity rate, we're going to end up spending a lot of money if corporations are allowed to market their stuff to children. And so what we're going to do is circumscribe the ability of corporations to market their goods to children. And we're going to stop corporations... we're going to limit the amount of advertising that they can do, and we're going to put some strict limits on this. In the United States, that would be an infringement of corporations' First Amendment's rights to free speech. And in fact, I don't know whether you caught earlier on this, it was last year, where one of the tobacco corporations was suing Walgreens because Walgreens wouldn't sell their cigarettes. And the corporation was basically saying, but that's an affront to our right to free speech. It's true that the corporations have have this legal personhood that means that they are tremendously powerful. In the book, I talk about how actually communities in the United States have passed ordinances stripping corporations of the right to personhood, which I think is tremendously exciting. I think that once communities realize, well, wait, we can do that? We can strip corporations of their right to personhood? I think that's an idea that whose time has come. But it's certainly true that the way corporations behave is like sociopaths. The film The Corporation demonstrates this very well. Corporations are utility maximizing. They are, in fact, that if we're looking for homo economicus, if we're looking for this utterly selfish bastard, we won't find it as among normal human beings, but we will find it among corporations, as natural people. And that's just because of the rules that they've set up. And it's normal human beings following the rules. I've met lovely people who are head of corporate social responsibility in like Unilever, for example. Wonderful guy. Loves his kids. He cares passionately about improving the lot of workers who work for Unilever. He admits very freely that if it ever comes down to a choice between doing the right thing for workers or increasing profits by a cent, they're going to increase profits by a cent, because anyone who doesn't do that is going to be out. When there is a win-win for profits and people, of course, they'll do the win-win. But when there isn't, corporations will do the sociopathic thing rather than the right thing to do. And that's that shouldn't surprise us. We shouldn't be surprised that corporations are out to make a buck. That's what we've unleashed them on the world to do. Unfortunately, they are sort of rather like Frankenstein's monster, and we do need to reclaim from them the rights that we have given them, sometimes by accident, but which they have swelled to turn into that's made them incredibly dangerous if we want a more sustainable future.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our guest today is Raj Patel, author and activist, who's discussing his critique of America's free market economic system. We have a question here that says, how do you, if you could change one thing in the American consumer's behavior, one thing, what would it be?
This is the sort of question that you've got to wriggle out of. And you've got to say, well, the one thing we've got to do is give up on the idea that there's just one thing that we've got to do. if it's one thing, then let it be consume less. Rather than shopping smarter. I think opting out of that game and instead, getting involved in local politics. Do less of the consuming, be less of that person, and be more of the kind of person who is not just about individual utility maximization, but is about caring in a community. And there are so many ways of doing that. You don't have to go very far to find ways in which you can stop being a consumer and be a more engaged citizen. But I think the way out of the consumer trap won't come through something you can put on your credit card.
Can you tell us the current status of the shack dwellers in Durban, South Africa, and what we can learn from their movement?
Whoever asked that question, I love you. You're great. Because this is a movement that I really care about. Let me just give you a little bit of background. Particularly in the United States, when we think about South Africa, the idea is that after apartheid ended, Nelson Mandela was made president, and there was great singing. They have a terrific national anthem, and it was like the end of Lion King, where it was a circle of life, and there he is, and Nelson Mandela is fabulous. Trouble is that South Africa has been very aggressively promoting free market capitalism and neoliberal capitalism. And as a result, levels of human welfare and of human development have been going down, so that now in South Africa, levels of human development are worse than in Palestine. And in particular, some of the areas of deepest poverty are in the shacks, are in not townships. Townships are what the apartheid government built in order to have a black workforce nearby. But the shacks are what, after apartheid, people were allowed suddenly to come to the cities. And so they built themselves shacks out of tin, out of boxes. In Zulu, they're called jondolos. Some people say it's because originally people made houses out of John Deere packing crates. And so it's jondolo after John Deere. But whatever the etymology, they live in these very sort of rudimentary houses. And they've been waiting very patiently since 1994 for things like electricity, for things like water. And in these spaces, people have organized. People think that apartheid ended in 1994, but in these communities, the struggle against apartheid is alive and well. And there's a certain kind of politics that existed in the struggle against apartheid, the United Democratic Front, which wasn't about the ANC, although the ANC now tries to rewrite history and pretend that it was the ANC that brought liberation. But in fact, it's the other way around. It's not that Nelson Mandela freed the people. The people freed Nelson Mandela. And that lesson is alive and well in the shacks. And so people have been agitating for transformation and for change and for basic rights to be recognized. And unfortunately, the ANC has turned into a party that sees the poor more as an irritant than as its natural constituency. And so as we head into 2010, where the world's largest sporting event will be happening in South Africa, where people will be playing football, in the 2010 World Cup, and it is called football. The ANC is getting very defensive, and so it's trying to clear out the poor in ways that look exactly like the apartheid regime was clearing out the poor. And in particular, shack dwellers have been attacked for organizing for their basic rights. I was there 3 weeks ago, and I was talking to some of the shack dweller leaders who were in a safe house because they'd been chased out of their homes by armed thugs, armed ANC thugs, it appears. In fact, we know for sure that it was armed ANC thugs. And you'd think that they would be bitter. You'd think that these leaders would be saying, yeah, we hate everyone in the ANC, we just want to get back. And I was blown away. It was an amazing moment where they were saying, actually, obviously it hurts to be chased out of your home, to have your home destroyed. But actually, the community that we've left behind, they're having a period of reflection now. And they're realizing that actually the ANC didn't bring development. Even though we were chased out, the ANC really hasn't done anything for them. And so the childcare facilities that we were providing, the AIDS drop-in clinic that we were providing, the services, the security, the organizing that we were doing in these communities has suddenly disappeared. And all of a sudden, the community now is rising up by themselves. They don't need a leadership. And that's a lesson from the United Democratic Front. That's a lesson in citizenship and in democracy that blew me away. Because if I were them, I'd be mad as all hell. I'd want revenge, frankly. My darker side would take over, I think. And what I learned from these leaders was actually no. You can trust people. People will make the right decision. I got goose pimples when I heard the leaders of this shack dweller movement saying, the people are going to do it themselves and they're going to make the right decision, and you just need to leave them to do it. At an individual level, the leaders of the shack dweller movement in Durban, they're in hiding and they're being protected by an international NGO from further attack. But the movement is alive and well, and that's very heartening.
But do you think these democratic solutions that you describe, can they grow into historical significance given the power of the corporation and their global influence and control over governments and military?
I follow Antonio Gramsci. I'm a pessimist of the intellect and an optimist of the will. Because I'm under no illusion that corporations are very powerful indeed. And certainly if you look at the grip that everyone from The arms industry, you know, when General Eisenhower, President Eisenhower was talking about the military-industrial complex, you know, that hasn't gotten smaller over time. And you know, when you look at the power that the banks have, you know, the Goldman Sachs seems to have sort of an almost telepathic ability to predict a day in advance whatever it is that the government is going to announce as policy. And you know, they obviously that's testament to the fact that they're doing God's work. I think we oughtn't to be naive about the power of these corporations, but do I think that it can achieve historical significance? Well, look to South Africa. Look to how apartheid was ended. It didn't happen because corporations urged it along. It happened because people around the world fought it and sometimes laid down their lives for it. Is that of historical significance? I think it is. And I think we have a lot to learn from movements for social change like that, that have actually, you know, that continue to inspire and that continue to offer solutions for becoming better, you know, better Democrats, better citizens, and better people.
But if financial costs do rise to reflect true cost prices, how do we ensure that the profit-maximizing corporations who collect those dollars actually apply those dollars to the correct environmental causes which they owe?
Certainly what we need to be doing is relying less on the benign goodwill of corporations. And as I say, relying a little bit more on regulation. In the book, I talk about the various ways in which corporations can behave like the sort of homo economicus. But they behave to follow the rules, and we set the rules. And I think that somehow we've forgotten that. If we are to get corporations to follow the rules in terms of internalizing externalities, we also need to be setting up rules so that resources can be diverted. And we have a history of governments able to make those decisions. Governments if you looked at Scandinavian governments, for instance, you have examples of where corporations are taxed, and the government will then invest it in public goods of one kind or another. It is possible to make this kind of change happen. The Scandinavian example is a very soft example of government regulation working to transfer, in a very modest way, externalities into public goods. I think that from that modest example, I think we have everything to learn and a great deal to build.
Well, you talk about regulation, but is the understanding of taking care of one another, is that really possible without some kind of spiritual approach as well? And how would that work in what's really totally a secular realm?
I'm very sympathetic to the idea that a more spiritual approach to dealing with one another is what we need. I don't believe in God, but I certainly think that the various approaches of the world religions are tremendously important. I cover them in the book, and in fact end with some Buddhist economics, drawing on E.F. Schumacher's wonderful book Small is Beautiful. I certainly think that there's a space for the connectedness that spirituality offers us. But I don't think that it should be mandatory. I certainly think while we have a lot to learn from the ways that religions encourage us to respect and to steward the environment and one another, that's something that we can build into a cultural framework that doesn't, you know, that respects people's individual religious preferences, but nonetheless encourages more connection.
So what do you think is the way to really value wages, comparing the factory line worker versus the CEO? And how do we get away from glorifying the decision makers over the people who do the real work?
That's a hell of a question to end on. I think that if we're looking at the wages, I certainly think that the vast gulf between what CEOs earn and what, you know, people on the shop floor earn is unconscionable. I used to have on my school briefcase a little sticker that said global maximum wage and global minimum wage. I still don't think that's a bad idea.
You had that in your school briefcase?
I was precocious. What can I say? I certainly think that if you look at the successful examples of economic cooperation that we see around the world, if you look at the Mondragon collectives, for example, the largest industrial collective in Spain, you have ways, mechanisms for setting remuneration that are pretty flat. That involve all workers sitting around a table deciding what everyone gets. And invariably people decide that if management is to get any kind of overhead, it's pretty minimal. And that to me seems like a much fairer way of setting wages than CEOs arrogating to themselves millions of dollars of bonuses setting the terms for the rest of us. And a way of taking away the power of these individual decision makers is really to have forms of economic organization that are much more like cooperatives and much less like the little empires that we've allowed corporations to be.
Well, we've reached the point where there's time for one last question, so I'll make it a short one, which is, what would you recommend that an average citizen do to take action against these problems without feeling overwhelmed?
Can I repeat that answer about the one thing that we should do? It depends on what moves you. I mean, for me, it's food. For me, I care a lot about food and about hunger. And I think that when 49 million Americans are going hungry, that's something that makes me angry. So I'm involved with an organization like Food First in Oakland that does terrific work around fighting hunger and the root causes of hunger. But really, it's whatever moves you. And you can find, in a heartbeat, organizations around everything from housing to healthcare to social justice to the environment that are getting to the root causes of these problems and are organizing around them. And if you're at a loss, you can drop me a line through my website, rajpatel.org. I will point you to the right direction. But actually, if you're interested, a good place to look will be the U.S. Social Forum that will happen in Detroit later on this year. And if you search for U.S. Social Forum, you'll find a number of organizations that are part of an alternative to the rule of free market capitalism. And I hope that you'll be convinced by the vision and the actions that they're putting into their efforts to make a better world possible. And I hope you'll be convinced not because I'm telling you in a British accent, but because the work that they're doing really is empowering U.S. citizens in ways that offer a bright light for the future.
Thanks to Raj Patel, activist, journalist, author, whose latest book is The Value of Nothing, How to Reshape Market Society and Redefine Democracy. And we also thank our audiences here and on radio, television, and the Internet. I'm Sandeep Roy, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, where you're in the know, is adjourned.